Previously on Popping Collars.
But can I say a word about MacGyver really quickly?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay. I didn't really know this was happening until you and I talked on the phone the other day. But I just want to shout out that MacGyver was like my legit first crush.
Really?
Yeah, like not even first like, but first like, I don't know why I feel this way. Like that kind of crush. Like I had a real crush on MacGyver.
Was it the mullet? Was it the...
He was a little rugged. Like, I think he was a little rugged and I liked that. Still do. And he was super nice. He was always like helping people. And he could like fix things with duct tape, which is a very appealing quality to me to this day.
That may be a little too warm.
Is that too much information?
You're taking the warm fuzzy thing a little far.
I'm just being real. I know you guys missed me. You missed that about me. I know.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I am your host. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida. With me is no one. That's right. It's our traditional season finale recap show. Thank you so much for supporting Popping Collars for two seasons. This time around, we got to talk to directors, producers, musicians, theology nerds, and lots of friends, both old and new. This is episode 50 of the, let's face it, probably 1,200th ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category. And we're looking back over the season that was. So it's time to cue the Wayne's World sound effects. Doodaloo, 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 doodaloo.
Criticism is really a form of pursuit where a person is attempting to name something to put their own anxiety or shame or whatever they're wrestling with on it. And so when you can name it and put it over there, then you feel like you're able to like get it out of you. And that kind of process is a very spiritual or relational one. If the internet and social media and all these things amplify the best and the worst, comment sections are like amplifying gossip from the church parking lot.
Yeah. What it's coming up for me is like this idea that doing takes courage, you know, like it takes putting yourself out there somehow. What it reminds me of in our parish life is how it's easy to think that there are professionals who do this and we should just leave it up to the professionals. So there are people that make podcasts and we should just leave it up to those people to make podcasts and we should listen to their podcasts and because they do it really well. But heaven forbid that I should actually jump in there, right? Because who am I? I'm not a professional, right? I just have a laptop. But it turns out that all you need is a laptop.
I'm 46 years old. My entire life I've heard the music of David Bowie. It's not that he's the music of my childhood or he was the music of my teen years or whatever. He's been releasing music for as long as I've been alive. There are many people like that. Like, I do not remember life without David Bowie. The earliest memory I have of watching a video on MTV was Little China Girl, right? And who is this David Bowie guy? I had no idea it's the same person as Ziggy Stardust, right? I had no clue because he's this chameleon, right? So the impact, it's not just momentary for me, right? When I talk about these people being theologians, it's not that one day I heard, you know, the words Ground Control to Major Tom and it was evocative in all these different ways and leads me to this understanding of the Trinity because blah. No, the first time it's this bizarre song about, you know, this guy who has a space odyssey. And it's a sad song. And it's trippy. That's the first time I hear it. Now, you know, fast forward however many decades, and I've added all this meaning to it. It's not simply the music of my childhood. It's the music of the last 40 years, right? That song shows up again and again and again for four decades. I hear it more than I hear the music that I hear in church, yeah. Right? I mean, that's the reason why I say our theologians are dying. Is, you know, we can all, everyone knows Amazing Grace, but that's because it's sung more than just on Sunday mornings once or twice a year. But the number of people who can sit down and recite the words to this, you know, Space Odyssey by David Bowie just explodes. Like, I'd love to have the statistics, the data on that. How many people could recite a song by David Bowie but not give you every verse from a hymn in the hymnal? Because we hear it so much. We simply make more meaning with it.
Oh, sure. Right. It's like the lectionary of our lives.
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
That's what,
right.
You know, as a music fan, and I would say this, you could do this with film and those sorts of things, that there's films that you can watch or albums that you can listen to when you're in your teens, to then listen to them in your 20s, to then listen to them in your 30s, and then to have a kid and listen to them, and then to lose a parent and listen to them, and then to, and that it changes, it alters. You read it in a different way. It is scripture.
Right.
And so you come to it differently every time.
For me, about Prince, and this wasn't huge, because I'm with you, Liz. I loved Prince in A Time and a Place. But after a while, it's like 39 albums, you know, probably half of those were like, okay, I don't need to hear that again. Sorry, Prince. But the big thing, the heady thing for me is Purple Rain came out in 1984, and that's the year I graduated high school. And that's, you know, I was all freaking closeted and freaked out. And so here's this guy singing about, like, not just on Purple Rain, about sex. And can I say these things on this show?
Yeah.
Head and, you know, jack you off and all this stuff, right? And it was, I was closeted, but we were dancing to it, and it was like sex was being talked about in this kind of, it was kind of scandalous, but it was out there, you know, at the bar where we went dancing, and it was out there on the radio. Well, not all the songs, right? But it was a way for me to kind of hear that sex was good and okay in this funny place. And the way that he mixed religion, that caught me too, because I was, you know, I was a pretty religious boy growing up. I didn't go to church in college, but I did growing up a lot, and it just tripped my trigger to hear him. Like, I, since he died, I realized, you know, the song Darling Nikki on Purple Rain, I don't need to repeat the lyric, I guess, but so the song is like, I guess I will, I met her in a hotel lobby masturbating with a magazine. So I'm like 17 years old, and I hear this, like, oh my God, that's amazing. Masturbation. They talk about masturbation. I've never, well, anyway. So, recently you find out that at the end of the song, do you know this about the end of the song, the backwards message? So the backwards message at the end of this song about, like, masturbation and, like, you know, chains and whips or whatever, it's like, hello, how are you? I'm fine, 'cause I know that the Lord is coming soon. At the end of that same song, and just like he did that. And to me, that was great. I mean, that those things echo against each other for some people like me who had religion and sex and didn't know how to reconcile them. And here's someone just being kind of out there with it.
Is it in your skin? Is it in your bones? All your honor undertow.
See, my experience as an Episcopalian is that we as individual people tend to be maybe more sex positive or more progressive when it comes to sexuality, but we don't necessarily have religious language for it. I don't think. Like, I don't think that we have a great, I don't know, ability to talk about. I mean, I don't know, Greg, do you, in your youth group, do you talk about sex?
There's an education piece of, like, figuring out for a lot of kids who only understand binary ideas of sexuality.
In the world that I came from, even now, I mean, they wouldn't even be taken seriously. Like, not even, like, close to being taken seriously. They would be laughed at or admonished. And that's why I made Henry Gamble. I felt like not having any indictment or criticism at all in that movie was a little, I don't know, maybe unfair to a lot of the people and adolescents who are being emotionally damaged by this hypocrisy. So I think there's some people who find Henry Gamble a little hard-hitting or borderline satirical or parodic or caricatures in some places, but it's like a deliberate choice to call – I mean, this movie is a deliberately trying to call them out for a lot of the grief that that world is causing. So still a very harmful environment for people who are questioning, and it needs to be called out, but in a human way. Otherwise, people won't engage with it.
I think the comparison to addiction really stands out for me. I've read some things recently that suggest that people are addicted not because of some internal brain chemistry per se, but because they don't have enough connections with other people, and that opens them up to addictions. And so I think young and old people both in our culture don't feel connected enough to others. So there's this strong desire to connect to other people, and sex always seems like a very intense way. So I wonder to what extent porn is people trying to fill in a hole because they're not connected enough with other people. And I feel like the church should have something to say about that, that healthy connections is something the church should be able to talk about, that that's part of the good news.
It just occurs to me also that, Liz, that you're what, canon to the ordinary?
Right.
So you're like the fixer, aren't you? In the diocese, you're like have to go. Are you like the fixer?
No, I mean historically, that's what the canon did. You mean so? Yes. Yeah. I'm really not. We're a way more collaborative team than that. But historically, that is what the canon to the ordinary was.
Yeah,
that would be amazing if your business card just said fixer.
I wish I was that much of a badass. It's not.
I just picture you rolling in like the wolf from Pulp Fiction.
Right, right? Yeah.
Like, what's the problem? How can I help?
Okay, somebody's been kidnapped. They want how much money? All right, just get it.
And it's interesting, you know, coming up on a presidential election year, how we see how, you know, having to make all these huge decisions can really start to wear you down as a person. And yet everybody expects you to be tough and to completely hold it together. And a lot of times you'll keep the appearance of keeping it together, but internally you're falling apart. And I think that might be what's been happening with Rick.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's trying to wrap your arms around the world. Like you can't hold it all together. You're just going to go crazy if you try to. But doesn't that speak something about the West? I mean, we've talked about that a little bit with the Breaking Bad story, this idea of like Westerns and hypermasculinity, and can you be a man? And to be a man is to sort of be able to take care of yourself and not rely on others and taking control of your destiny, being your own person, like all of that stuff. Like, I mean, you're right. This is a story of the West, and that seems to be a value that keeps popping up over and over again. This be your own man, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do your thing.
But that's not just. I mean, that's Wall Street too. I mean, that's not just the West. That is the American cultural storyline. And that's why we have problems with poor people and immigrants in our country. Is that we've got, and that's why Donald Trump is. You know, I don't know if we want to get all political here, but that's why Donald Trump is as popular as he is, because there are people that believe this mythology of the American dream, that if I just work hard enough, if I just pull myself up by my bootstraps, then I will be redeemed, right? This is about redemption in this case. Is that my story of redemption is that I will achieve the American dream. And that's infected our cultural consciousness to the extent that we don't have any mercy for one another. We don't have any, I wouldn't say, okay, not all of us obviously, but that mythology doesn't have any room for anyone else. It doesn't have any room for mercy. It doesn't have any room for compassion.
You know, I teach church history, and one of the things that I'm teaching 19th century stuff, one of the things I tell people is when you're dealing with the issue of sort of slavery in American Christianity, basically slavery in American society, the way in which we, for whatever reason, guilt, fear, ignorance, just a willingness to desire to avoid uncomfortable things, have kind of portrayed this into like good North, bad South. No, it's just entirely not true. Getting to what we're talking about, the slave economy infiltrated every aspect of American society. If you were a textile worker in Lowell, you were using cotton made by substandard labor, the banking industry, the shipping industry, the insurance industry. It permeated society. It wasn't a question of whether you engaged or not. You couldn't avoid it. You couldn't avoid it. Then was, how did you choose to carve out a certain kind of stance towards that? You know, there were like 7 different kinds of abolitionists. There were gradual abolitionists. There were sudden abolitionists. There were abolitionists who wanted to recolonize slaves, or abolitionists who did that. It wasn't a binary thing. It wasn't a simple thing. It was how, for lots of reasons, how you were raised, where you lived, what your religion was, what your job was. How can you carve out a way to deal with something that you simply can't avoid, but somehow that is informed by your values and you can live with yourself? We do it all the time. We do it all the time.
If you're trapped in a narrative of the past, if you're always looking past and everything you see in front of you is a mirror, or it's either a reflection of the past or it stands in opposition to the past or whatever, if you're always trapped in something back here, you're never the ability to look forward and see hope and see movement. It just cannot happen. And if you're then a person who's either dealt with that story and is no longer a prisoner of that story, even though that story hunts you and aliens from your world find you, you're not going to be a prisoner of that past, and that you tend to look forward. And I think that is when we talk about the psychological differences in us and why we chose perhaps the characters we chose, that backwards looking all of the time, that feels like a prison, as opposed to, and always being in that well with the best, as opposed to the ability to look forward and imagine something that you don't know exactly what it's going to look like, and how you're supposed to be in relationships with other people and be as different as you are, but that you're at least trying.
Yeah, Batman entombs himself. He buries himself.
Yeah.
And it's funny, that opening sequence where the bats are raising him out of the grave, like he's being brought into the light, and he talks about, I was going into the light. He never goes into the light. He always goes back underground. He always keeps burying himself, entombing himself, going back into his pain and back into... I mean, this is a man who really needs reconciliation. He needs something, right? And it's funny because that's something that we never think. I mean, I think about it, you know, in parishes. The rite of reconciliation is something that I never even think about. And yet it's a sacrament that's right there in front of us, and we ignore it so much.
And we like to pretend our pain is something we can't get over. I think there's the word isn't comfort, because it doesn't actually make you stronger, but there's this desire to retreat into yourself and say, I'm not powerful enough to overcome this, therefore it's acceptable for me to wallow.
I think nostalgia can be bad. I think it can be something that puts us in a place where we're not moving. And I also think that, you know, skillful artists and writers and preachers are actually really good at using our nostalgia as a hook to bring us to a new place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of so many times where we're sort of given images or sequences that we're used to that remind us of something else. And then when it's spun a different way, then all of a sudden we're actually able to inhabit the moment better because it's paired with something that makes us comfortable. So, I mean, I think that if it's used right, it can actually be a really neat thing. I mean, back to sort of thinking popular culture, you know, for me, the Creed movie was sort of an interesting example of that, in that you have something that, you know, captures a lot of the same things that, you know, the original Rocky movie did. But, you know, all of a sudden it's a brother, and, you know, it had a different flavor because of that. And, you know, that same belovedness was now sort of surrounding him. I mean, that's just an example where I feel like, you know, so many nostalgic diehards would be drawn in, and all of a sudden they find themselves wrapped up in a really different character. You know, as long as you give people enough, or at least a taste of what they had before, that you can actually move with them.
Edwin, what you said just now made me think of liturgy as a whole. Like, one of the things that people love about our Episcopal liturgy, and I'm sure that this is true in other liturgical traditions, is that so often it feels like coming home. It's comfortable, it's known, it's beloved, it takes us to a deeper place, a pathway that we know how to get to a deeper place. And sometimes people criticize that, I think, saying like, oh, that's rote, that's stale, it's not current or whatever. But the fact is that if we use that liturgy well to glorify God, you know, first and foremost, and to bring people into a closer relationship with Christ, we can actually find ways to be super current and even subversive and, you know, speak to this moment and this time using ancient ways of worship, which I guess for some of us is nostalgic.
We used to stay up all night sometime while our people getting high. We would cry, and just to get by, had to turn to the life of crime.
I actually had a parishioner die today.
Oh my God.
My word, my condolences. And gave the administration of at time of death yesterday. He had his wife call me telling me he was dying. And so I went over yesterday or last night, and we said, you know, everything together. We said the Lord's Prayer together. He took communion. You know, he was physically in distress. But he was certainly aware of what was going on. There is a part of death, I think, but can be beautiful.
Oh, I completely agree.
And I think it's even though physically he wasn't in peace, I think mentally he was wrapping his everything with a bow and getting ready to setting it down, his little pack beside him, and getting ready to leave the world. And that was the pretty part. So, and then he died this afternoon. So, right. And he wasn't. His wife was actually my parishioner. He rarely came to church, but he had her call me yesterday and tell me he was dying and wanted to talk with me.
Oh, that's
so. Weird. We did, and there's just some peace there to that. I mean, I realize not all deaths are peaceful. I certainly understand that, but I've seen some peaceful ones, and I'm sure you all have too, and it's it can be amazing
with this balance in the force, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that's been talked about in terms of the religion of Star Wars and where Lucas pulls things from. You know, is it Taoism? Is it yin yang? Is it balance? Because that means there is always going to be evil. Are we trying to eliminate darkness? Are we trying to make it go away? Or is it really this Zoroastrian, this transition from Old Testament to New Testament? There's this introduction of light and dark and good and evil, this dualism that exists, the same side of the same thing. And it gets woven into Christianity and woven into Judaism after they spend time with the Persians for a while. And I've wondered about if it's supposed to be balanced, we're always going to have it. And is it always balanced inside us? Or is it that we're really trying to move towards light and dark? And that's what Kylo has been making me think about that I hadn't thought about before.
Well, there was that scene where he was talking to Darth Vader's helmet, but it felt, until you saw what was lying there on the bench, it felt like he was praying, right? I mean, that was the sense that I got. And he's saying, he's so frustrated, and he's like, I feel it inside of me again. I feel the light side of the force again. And to me, like you said, Gideon, for me, that experience is usually the opposite. Like, oh my God, I feel that bad thing. You know, I feel those bad feelings or my shadow side or whatever. And like, God, please help me to balance that out. But so it's.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that the force just was. It's neutral, and it's how it's used, that it can be used for great evil or for great good. And I felt like that the conflict, the difference there between kind of the radical Yahwism of the Bible is that all good and evil are within the compass of God's creation.
So the kids submit, here at school, submit questions for the chaplains, and we put them in an empty Twizzlers box, and we draw questions out in front of everybody instead of a sermon. That's what we do. We do questions, random questions, and it's terrifying as well. But I got the question of, you know, do you think that God controls all of our life, or things what we make of them? Mm-hmm. And so that whole idea of, you know, because some people would use the phrase that Kilgrave is playing God, right? That he is in control of everything. You go walk off the building and you go do this and that kind of thing. And I think that element of how flawed that system actually is and what a gift that ability for free will is. And I hadn't thought about, Liz, what you were saying, that those moments when she confronts people being controlled and they know they're being controlled. Mm-hmm. I just, oh, that is just a killer. That's just a killer. So it's, yeah, I think that element of the importance of human beings and free will and how we can screw up and how we can make good choices and how we can make bad choices, and to have that, have yourself robbed of that to serve the means of another. I think oftentimes people think that's what religion is. They think that that's, there's an element of that, that that's what God wants, you know, that we submit. And then you just become something else. And there's some little book that has day planner that has your life in it. And this is what's going to happen. And then you're going to mic drop on this day and it's over, you know. And, but I think this made me wrestle around with some of those ideas.
Yeah. Because if that were true, I wouldn't worship that God. You know, if God had mind control over my life, I would be like, God, what are you doing? What? Like, I am too broken and sinful a person to worship that God. I can see why if people really thought that that's what was going on, it would be a horrifying sale, I guess, for religion. I wouldn't buy it.
It would be God who would be making you horrible.
Right,
sinful,
I know.
Right?
Right.
So, yeah, what's that all about?
Yeah.
What a rigged game.
Yeah.
But I think that concept, I agree, of the kids and the game is very interesting, and that some people cheat in the game, Peter Baelish being the best example, I think, or even, I mean, Cersei and Jaime and killing off Robert Baratheon and all of that. I mean, there's some people that are trying to play the game honorably and not cheat. I think of playing a board game with my family and my children, and my number one goal is to make sure my children don't cheat at Monopoly or something and take extra money out of the bet. But does that teach them to win the game, or does that teach them to be poor beheaded Starks down the road?
Right.
It's also, we see in the Game of Thrones that being cunning is maybe the best thing. A wit and a fast talker. Like, how in the world is Tyrion still alive? There's no reason that he should be there. Or, I can't think of his name, the one who talks to the birds.
Varys.
Yeah. Like, he's another one that's like a smooth talker and can sort of get himself out of a situation by saying, let me connect you better. Let me help you cheat, and we'll get that person back. That really makes it game-like. Not that we would want, if we're playing Monopoly, we don't want that, but...
But I do like that idea of cunning, though. Like, because there's nothing wrong with being cunning, necessarily. I mean, hell, the whole book of Genesis wouldn't exist if it weren't for cunning people that populate the patriarchs. The whole state of Israel is named after probably the most cunning character from the Bible, in Jacob, right? I mean... Like, it's an admirable trait. It's just, how are you using it? Are you using it to advance your own power, or are you using it on behalf of your chosen people?
Yeah, and you start to think about, well, the parents episode is a great one, because you start to think about, what are the chasms that kind of exist between us and our relationships and stuff? And, like, what are the experiences that, you know, creating distance between us that... Sometimes you have to sit down at a table and have these conversations with each other, even if it's the most uncomfortable thing in the world.
Even if they're awkwardly phrased questions that, that prompt these stories.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of, you know, at least the episodes that I recall the best are the ones where he's really trying to understand another point of view. So he's trying to understand where his parents are coming from. He's trying to understand Rachel and all his female, you know, commercials, whatever, castmates, whatever you call them. And he's really, you know, like, you can see him visibly struggling on the screen. Yeah, and I think he kind of hemmed it up a little bit, but you can really, really see him. He wants to connect. He wants to understand. And I think the scene where Rachel's, you know, they're walking, I think when she's still, you know, pissed off at him, and she's walking with him on the street saying, you just won't, you know, there's no way you can ever get my experience. And I don't know, you know, I was trying to imagine sort of like how he would feel in that moment, because, you know, it's like I've been doing a lot of thinking recently because I'm doing anti-racism work in our diocese, and so I'm thinking a lot about, you know, white privilege and sort of like different privileges that I have as a person of color. Like, I have different, you know, like, it's like there's so many different layers of experience that one can have, and just being, I think a lot of it is just coming to peace with, yeah, there are certain things that you will never fully experience, but, you know, how can you have empathy? How can you, you know, how can you still connect despite that? And, you know, it's absolutely necessary to be able to connect to have any progress made on anything. I personally really struggle with that. Yeah, so watching him sort of do it on screen is interesting.
This illness takes over shortly after their marriage, shortly after they're starting their life together. And to go into a relationship with the expectations that you have of any relationship, you know, it's going to be like this for the next 50 years and we're going to love each other and blah, 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 to then really put that to the test, like right away, of are you really going to take care of me when I need an enema, you know, on the toilet, or when I need, you know, someone to set my child on my lap because I can't ask, you know, for myself and stuff like that. I just thought that was amazing how you ask so much of that relationship.
Well, and are you going to stick by me when I'm going to die on you?
Yeah. Gosh, that's got to be so scary. I mean, that's got to be terrifying.
I just felt like we took a jump off a cliff there. You know, Kevin, that's a great question because I walked away thinking, how do I answer that? Being married 11 years, am I still prepared to take that leap? And then also to reexamine my own life and say, am I giving enough to the person that I've said I want to be with? Am I being the best person that I can be for that person?
That starts so early. I don't think I was prepared for like how early these pop culture items would come into my kids' lives. I remember being at the hospital after the girls were born and they had like Sesame Street newborn diapers. And I was like, huh, right away, yeah. We're doing the Sesame Street thing. And then, you know, of course, like the whole like Disney industry, like the Mickey Minnie stuff, like they're so aware at such an early age, my girls anyway, of like who these characters are and kind of what they represent and what the differences are between them. And it's amazing to me how quickly that indoctrination happens and how widespread it is. You know, how it reaches so many children.
Isn't that because you live in Florida?
Okay, the Disney thing, maybe.
You do, like, day trips to Disney World, for God's sake. You are
okay.
A full participant.
Don't shame me and my Disney participation.
Betsy, he goes for himself.
I'm with you. Yeah, he does.
Look, when I say I work at a church, what I mean is the Church of the Mouse. And sort of holding this whole thing down is this kind of messiah figure president who he went to Notre Dame because he was thinking about becoming a priest. And it's like, ah, really, Bartlett? Like, you are killing me with this sappiness. Like, this is totally driving me crazy. Like, how decent and how good can somebody be? And how, you know, and that seems to just kind of drive the show.
I love that because, like, a little insight into my personality is that I literally think that everybody is like that. I have this kind of assumption of goodness and benevolence and integrity in everyone that I meet and work with. And in some ways, that's a real handicap for me. But, you know, so far, so good.
Nobody can be too good for you, though.
No.
Not Liz.
Is this what we really want it to be? Katie Ledecky swimming her heart out for the gold medal? Or is she just part of something so much larger that even, what, Christ Redeemer can't wrap his arms around, like, all of this stuff? It's just too, it's just so big.
Don't you drag, Katie.
Well, you know, the next time...
I'm rooting for the local girl here.
The next time the Olympics are in the United States, it's just going to be nothing but Katie Ledecky and
all the time.
Yeah,
well,
just,
and who sponsors the medal count? Right, every time. Who is it?
I don't know. Coca-Cola, McDonald's.
McDonald's every time. McDonald's. And the medal count brought to you by McDonald's.
Your face, your hair, your sense of humor.
there was backlash again. So let's talk about the backlashy stuff, because that's something that I'm totally curious about, as to like, okay, yeah, so you've got like this boy world of like Star Wars or comic books or whatever. It's almost like it's a personal insult when you put a female lead or a non-white male as the lead for a lot of these things, right? So there was a lot of backlash on the new Rogue One trailer, because it's another Star Wars franchise that features a woman in the lead role, or at least seemed to feature a woman in the lead role based on the trailer. And there was this backlash again online of like, oh my God, another girl in charge of Star Wars. Like, when are we ever going to, like, where's Luke Skywalker? Like, why can't we get some dudes in here? And that happens, like, that happened with Ghostbusters. Yeah, I guess that's the thing. It's like, where's this anger coming from? Like, what is that anger all about?
Change.
Well, that reminds me of the way that when we suggest a feminine aspect of God, people get all up in arms. Like, we've somehow taken something away from God or the men who refer to him. It's a diminishment, I guess, is the implication.
I mean, as a culture, the patriarchy wants women to be objects that can be taken. The patriarchy values women being weak and vulnerable and property. So the idea of like Almighty God being any of those things is not only offensive, but I think it does inspire anger. I think that there's a lot of violence at the heart of misogyny.
I grew up, like, I had a lovely class my senior year of high school that was called Advanced Philosophy in Human Behavior, which is one of those classes that if you've taken all your prerequisites and you have a teacher who's really offering a class on everything they want to teach, that's what that was. So yeah, it was philosophy and philosophers, and then the 1960s, and that's what the class was. It was awesome. And so I read Helter Skelter for that class and became very intrigued by how disparate groups that have a faith aspect in a weird sort of way find people who they attract. And the girls kind of taps into that. And so I audiobooked it and listened to it. It's really good. And I went looking it up because I'm like, okay, so what is Black Mirror? Arcade Fire also has a song named after this. So I went hunting, and here we can quote Wikipedia. Claude Glass is the other name for Black Mirror. And it was used by artists, travelers, and connoisseurs of landscape and landscape painting. And it's like a black mirror. It looks like a black mirror. And so you would use it. It's almost kind of like hashtag filter, right? Mm-hmm. So Claude Glass's had the effect of abstracting the subject reflected in it from its surroundings, reducing and simplifying the color and tonal range of the scenes, particularly scenery painting, giving it kind of a painting quality. So I found that so interesting. So this is like, so we're filtering reality in some way in each of these episodes. We're filtering something that the filmmakers want to make a commentary on and looking at it in a very particular way.
Yeah, and at the risk of stating the obvious, another meaning is this is every screen there is when the power is turned off. Suddenly it's this is you staring back from this kind of inky void.
Mm. Yeah, because the things that feel the grossest about it are the things that you're like, ooh, that's me, or ooh, no, and that is, you know, when we rubberneck, when we, you know, do whatever.
Yeah.
Those moments feel the grossest. And I mean, and that is, this is essentially parable. That's what Jesus liked to do all the time. He's going to use things that you're familiar with, mostly. So it's setting, you know, roles that you understand, like politician or priest or whatever, people you understand in a concrete way or have assumptions about, to then tell you a story where your behavior is being called out in the story more than like, you know, I've been hating on Samaritans for years, but then the Samaritan's the hero. What the what? You know, that sort of idea.
Yeah, I think if Rodrigo were sitting next to me, he would say that he would not have known how to approach the story of the divine Jesus, that he would not be able to properly represent divinity. He, you know, I think he's a very humble guy, but I think he feels strongly about that. Whereas if you're looking at the human Jesus, that's an interesting supposition to make, right? And calling out for my father and not hearing and questioning the father's love and being vulnerable. Vulnerability is a very human, it's just a very human state of being, vulnerability. And because Yeshua was human, then Yeshua must have experienced vulnerability. And so that is a place that an artist, a filmmaker can put themselves and say, in those circumstances, how might we explore that? And how might that have value for us as an audience or a community in conversation about it? What's valuable about vulnerability? What's instructive about vulnerability? What is common and universal about vulnerability? And you can only have that conversation in reference to Jesus if it's the human Jesus. You can't really have that conversation about the divine risen Jesus.
Popping Collars on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars, and you can find all of our archived episodes at poppingcollarspodcast.com. Our most recent episodes are available wherever you get your podcast: iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. All we ask is that you subscribe, rate, and review to our show. That way people will be able to find us in our next season coming up. And as always, we ask that you check us out on EpiscopalCafe.com. We love EpiscopalCafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all your Episcopal news needs and beyond. And check out all of our partner podcasts who will be able to fill the gap while we're gone for the next couple of months. Too Fab, Priest Pulse, From All Points. They're all great shows, and we ask that you check them out. And with that, that is season two of Popping Collars. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you all in a few months when we start back on season three. Until then, keep those collars popped, and we'll see you next time.